This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. On today's episode, I had the chance to speak with my friend Stephen Delaporte. He's the founder and CEO of Avar Robotics, where they incorporate mechanics, structures, and electronics to build next-generation robots. We had a great conversation where he shares his thoughts on the art of invention, philosophy, music, and what happens when the world catches up to your ideas. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for coming to Utility Function. So great I got to speak with you just yesterday, and then we have a chance to speak for our listeners. You know, I like to bring on people that not only hopefully have ideas and inspiration for our listeners, but for myself too. And we don't see each other often, but every time I feel slightly inspired and wanting to try new things. So thanks for coming on.
Absolutely, yeah.
And when I look at all of these other people I've spoken to on this podcast, there's something that keeps coming up, which is, why is it now that large corporations like Alphabet and Apple, companies that you've had some involvement with, but you know, on the periphery in some sense, now they have huge staffs, huge budgets, but at the same time, I would say not enormous amounts of invention.
Right.
And I think what's so interesting is that you are not a lone inventor, but an inventor the way that I picture somebody at the turn of the century being. Do you ever think about this? And do you have any explanation for why that could be?
Yeah, that's really interesting topic, because I think when you overly structure something, there's something that gets lost in that process. And I think when you have a large company that has tens of thousands of employees, sometimes hundreds of thousands of employees, you know, people are going, they're structured in such a way that they're going from 9 to 5. And of course, companies like Google are a little bit different. They have their 10 or 15% time where they can be creative and work on their own projects.
Yeah, but what about your process then? Differ maybe? Or if you know, even if you're not super familiar with what they're doing on a daily basis, how does somebody like you come up with so many inventions?
I mean, I think I used to actually have an ongoing sketchbook at all times. Like, I would come up with an idea sometimes, 10 ideas in a day, and I would sketch them out in the sketchbook, and it was filled with thousands of ideas. And it was interesting because I think I transitioned from, you know, someone who was thinking like an engineer to someone who was thinking more like an entrepreneur at some point. And that was a really important transition, because an entrepreneur has to think about, how am I going to generate revenue? How am I going to make money from these products? How is it going to be valuable on a mass scale? If you're working on an orphan product, like if it's a medical device that's, you know, kind of niche, it's hard to justify getting funding for that. You know, obviously, the government can step in and fund those things. But if you're going to bring it to market, it's extraordinarily difficult. And so I think, you know, that whole process for me was about finding something that was compelling intellectually, that and had a certain level of complexity that I could also bring to market and scale. And so
what's interesting, though, about what you just said was that you used to keep these notebooks, and then you started thinking, like, have you stopped the notebooks?
Well, I do keep notebooks for engineering work. You know, if I'm working out some details of a mechanism, or you know, if I'm designing a circuit, I like to work out, you know, all the different sections of it. And actually, I have certain notebooks where I sketch very quickly, and then I have other notebooks where I carefully sit down and I draft all the details out, you know, because I like to go back and check it as if it was like a final schematic. But I don't really sketch out ideas as much. If I sketch out an idea, it's usually on like a napkin or a scrap piece of paper, and then I end up throwing it out. I think I have my original sketch for some of the foldable, flexible display device designs I had from, you know, 12 years ago, on some napkins. But
since you say that, I want to talk a little bit about flexible devices.
Sure.
I mean, I could just ask you what they mean to you, but what's interesting is how early you were in this, and also why the rest of the world has taken so long to catch up to your inventions. If you want to give a bit of a background on flexible electronics and your involvement in it, that would be so interesting to us, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was right after the iPhone launched in 2007 that I started thinking about the concept of you know, expanding the display, right? It was that simple. And so I wasn't necessarily thinking about flexible displays in particular. I was just thinking about how can I solve this problem of, you know, you probably remember the first time you used an iPhone, and the experience is similar now. The iPhone X or the 10 is dramatically larger, but the smaller iPhones, there's that issue where you want to zoom into some detail. Maybe you're looking at a map, and you know it's frustrating because you're trying to type at the same time, and you have this limited display. And so what if you could take that display and expand it out to something larger? And so what was interesting is, at that time, I was thinking about tablets before the notion of a tablet or the term tablet wasn't even in the vernacular of the pedestrian consumer. You know, I mean, it was that early. I mean, the iPad was launched in sometime in 2010. And that's when, the tablet industry really took off. I mean, arguably, there were tablets before it, but, you know, it wasn't super pervasive yet. And so that was really, the frustration that I had. And I was actually going to a lecture at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and I was driving, and I got a little bit lost, and I wanted to recalibrate and check the map on my iPhone. And I pulled over to the side of the road, and I just remember at that point, I was trying to zoom in to, where the location of the lab was, and I was like, there has to be a way to expand this display. And then I started doing more research on flexible displays, and the first viable colored flexible displays were presented in around 2010. Before that, they existed, but it was mostly black and white. There was no one, even in 2010, no one was really thinking about how you can enable it with a touchscreen. Right. So all the early patents, I'd say most of them, in fact, maybe all of them don't even mention the idea of a touchscreen.
So I go back to that time. So this is 2010. You started thinking about this when iPhone launched in 2007.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is a time of your life where you're still keeping notebooks. You're an inventor. Do you have the commercial hat on at all yet? Or was this a sort of transformative thing where you saw commercial potential?
It's a great question because I was actually working. So I had a general company that was doing contract work, and we kind of wanted to be a miniature Bell Labs, and so I could pursue all these different ideas I had for inventions and do contract work for other companies to stay afloat and fund the other projects. And I still have a similar model today. It's always good to be supportive of other startups and what they're doing, especially of the engineering skills that are unique to provide value to other startups. But at that time, I was working on that company, and the main project we got funding for was actually low-cost medical devices for developing countries. And so I had already been thinking about, foldable, flexible display devices, and so they were kind of happening at the same time. And so I was actually thinking, I was starting to transition into becoming an entrepreneur at that time and thinking more about how you could bring a product that was viable, with customer feedback and it was robust, how it would be robust in the marketplace. And we had great partners. We had a distribution channel to like 200 countries, something like that, through a nonprofit. And that was an interesting startup because we were incredibly ambitious. We were probably one of the most successful startups in that space, but
in the medical,
in the sort of medical, low cost medical devices for emerging markets, mm-hmm. And now it's really huge. I mean, Philips has a whole research facility in Africa, that was a project that was shelved eventually. Unfortunately, we raised some money and we couldn't raise follow up capital. But all the while, I kind of had a sense of frustration because I was working on these medical devices. I knew I was doing something great for the world. I knew it was going to be valuable. I knew that we could build a great business from it. And yet, at the same time, I knew that if I put the same energy into something that was in a bigger market, maybe, that was in the developed world, that would be profitable, and I could take those profits and reinvest them into more of these sort of philanthropic type projects. And so that's kind of, that helped pushed me further on that particular project, because the mobile device market is huge. And I said, if I'm right about this, then I've effectively invented the next paradigm shift.
I mean, you certainly were right. Now let's talk about timing a little bit on this, because so you were talking about the early patents were 2010-ish, you said, for flexible devices and flexible displays.
Yeah, so 2010 was when I filed my first patent.
And when were Samsung filing? At around the same time?
The first flexible display patents were filed by Universal Display Corporation, which is in New Jersey and California, and they actually have a license with every single company in Asia. You know, most of the manufacturers are in Asia. In fact, I think almost all of them, some in Europe. But they have exclusive license with all these companies, BOE in China, Samsung, LG, all these companies that are doing this. And so Samsung has some early patents on, concepts that relate to flexible displays, but it's, their device designs really deal with rollable displays. And that was a big idea back then.
I know. I was really into that idea of you take because there's still, people are still used to newspapers. Right. You're going to roll it up. You're going to put it in your bag. You're going
It makes perfect sense.
Really happened though in that way, did it?
Yeah. And I guess that was one of the things that I figured out early on, was that a rollable display, the problem with it is that when you roll it up, it's very thick. And the mechanics of it is actually very tricky, because if you want to deploy a rolled display in such a way that it's expanded, you need to have some kind of backing for that, and that backing actually has to roll up with the rest of the device.
Been true with OLEDs and things in general, right? That you have something that is inherently interesting because it's flexible, and yet we have them all rigid because it actually doesn't have the best yields and has some issues with it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So you had these ideas, you had strong engineering concept behind it. Had you done prototypes of flexible displays?
Yeah. So when I filed the first patent, I believed in flexible displays, and I believed that, I was having a lot of meetings with a professor at Columbia, John Kimesis, and, we had discussed the idea of how you could apply a touchscreen to a flexible display, because no one was really working on that. And in the simplest way, if it was rollable, that was another limitation to rollable, incidentally. If you make it rollable, then how do you make it into a touchscreen enabled display? And now it's more obvious how you do that. But back then, the idea of a foldable display, you could conceivably add two touchscreen panels to the two segments that are being folded against each other, and then you have this small gap. So you can use software to fill in the gap for the touchscreen. And so we deduced that you could actually, feasibly build a touchscreen into a foldable display. But at that time, I wasn't 100% sure flexible would ever take off. And so in my first patent, I actually cover tiled display configurations, so the same transformation but using tiled. And I show it in eight segments, and six segments, and four segments, and two segments. And then I, at the very end of the patent, I have the flexible display design. And that's really, it's very fortunate that I put that in there, because I was almost hesitant, because really, no one really knew.
Yeah.
And I was like, I need to put this in here just in case.
Amazing. And that's where this value comes from.
Yeah,
this is what we see now.
Huge amount of value, because my first flexible display device patent beat out Apple by about a year. And that patent, the reason why it grabbed our attention and the people that ended up investing is because it's been referenced dozens and dozens of times.
Yeah, by all the major companies.
Yeah, by every major company you could think of. Even, companies that you wouldn't think of, like Facebook and Google or HP. Yeah. Companies that are not really...
Yeah, I know these are cited all the time. It's referenced all the time. No, it's really interesting to see that... I mean, for your age, you kind of come up in... If I go back to that time period, and by the way, I think we kind of overlapped when we're lecturing at Columbia, right? So it was around the same time period.
Yeah, probably.
And
I was working the senior engineer class.
Yeah, and I was in I was teaching about polymers and stretchable and flexible materials and how they could be displays, but I didn't know how to do anything. But what's interesting is that you're in that time of your life, you're an inventor. But there was all this sort of either open source stuff going on at the time, or tying things to universities, and getting wrapped up in tech transfer and these types of things. Somehow your entrepreneur, how did you think, why go to the patent right away? I mean, that's very businessy thinking at the time when you're trying to work something out. Have you always been convinced that intellectual property protection is key to...
It's an interesting question because up until I filed that patent, I had been filing patents on average about every 1 to 2 years. So I had a number of patents that had already been filed or issued mm-hmm. by the time I filed that patent. And when I filed that patent in 2010, I was so discouraged actually because, you know, I put so much energy and money into that patent and I was, you know, I knew that if I was really going to compete in this marketplace, I'd have to partner with an Apple or Samsung or a major OEM. There's no way I could survive in that market, but at least I can file valuable IP and then transition in, you know, the work into some product with an Apple type company. And so, yeah, it was a very business move, but on my part. But interestingly, I didn't file for another patent for years because I was actually really discouraged by it because no one took me seriously. They were like, the flexible display device market, why are you wasting your time?
It's usually a good sign that you're onto something. I noticed. It's going to be a shame and despair, but you're on to something when people tell you that it's ridiculous and you've just shown that it can be done.
Right. And so I survived that for almost a decade and tried to raise money for it. People said, you know, some people were kind enough to say, oh, this is really great work. It's very academic. There's not going to be a market for it anytime soon, but keep working on it, see where it goes. And then all of a sudden, 2019, Samsung Galaxy Fold came out and was launched. And, you know, I mean... It wasn't launched, you know, it was launched with well reception. And then once it started shipping, there were those issues, or not shipping the actual product, but the demo units, there were issues and they went back to the drawing board and fixed those few issues that were happening with it. And it's been doing great in the marketplace. It was launched in the end of September. Huawei Mate X launched, which they've both sold out immediately. Huawei Mate X sold out in seconds. I read that they sold 1 million Samsung units, but I don't know if that's entirely accurate. The projection was between 500,000 and 1 million, which is really extraordinary.
Well, my guess is if they improve yields and bring down, commoditize it the way the rest of the Samsung phones are, they would sell more than anything.
It's a beta device and it's $2,000 and it's selling really well. It's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And everyone else is getting into the game now. Motorola Razr has one, which has gotten really great reviews. It hasn't shipped yet, but the review units have been doing, getting really amazing reviews. And Xiaomi is working on one that has a trifold. Or three panels.
I like to hear you talking about everything going on in the industry, but most of all, it's interesting that you have this time that you were in despair. I'm really interested in this because I want to trace back to what gave you the inspiration to be an inventor in mm-hmm. the first place, mm-hmm. to what, you know, you went through this time of despair to now you're speaking about this as a kind of triumph, right? It doesn't matter to me in this conversation, you know, the finances and how it worked out for you and whether you've been completely rewarded or exalted for your invention. But you have the world caught up to your ideas. That's exciting. That's really exciting. So now you have a company, Avar, and are you writing patents again?
So Avar Robotics, we only have a couple of patents. So I think what happened with that was actually a similar experience with Lepton, the mobile device, foldable mobile device company, where I filed a really long patent that can be split out into many continuation patents. I think that's just, it happens to me a lot where I just have so many ideas and, you know, it's more cost effective to just put everything in the one patent. It can be problematic because,
I'm so happy you're not scared away from invention though forever from that. You're not too scarred.
Oh yeah. And that's the intriguing thing about my process or my experience is that I didn't give up on other kinds of inventions. I thought, well, I'm just going to shelf this project because at that time it was just a project, right? I mean, I had a little holding company, but I started to explore many other areas of technology, and saw moderate success here and there. You know, I worked on a product that did really well for GoPro, 360-degree camera. I worked on a successful wearable tech product, the first wearable charger for the iPhone. And then I worked on some medical devices for Johnson & Johnson, which was really exciting. And
yeah, you're one of those people that I can't be around where you're not going to know something more about than me in any area, especially of hardware. And
yeah, when it comes to electromechanical hardware, I mean, I kind of like
it's
covered
it's intimidating everything. To me. But to go to somebody to do this, it's a rare thing, right? One thing I've been really lucky about the people I've talked to, they've all had this intellectual curiosity that's led to creativity. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly true for you. When did this start? Do you have a sense of what made you think that it was possible to create things that nobody else had created? Was there somebody that guided you through this, or did you read a book? What is the?
I guess there have been inventors in my family, which I found to be greatly inspiring. And you know, my dad is a very technical minded person who had a background in engineering in school, and I feel like I was always really around hardware growing up, and I started building circuits when I was 8. And then I actually found this old electricity. It was something from Radio Shack, but it was, you know, connect up the circuits and 101 circuits or something like that. And it had various op amps inside and amplifier circuits and all kinds of circuits. And it's interesting, if you look through the book, it actually has electronic schematics, so you can learn real electronics as you're building it.
Curious if anybody of our generation, or if, let's say 30 years old, was not going to Radio Shack in order to find their...
Yeah, Radio Shack, amazing. It sounds so archaic.
No, I know. I am curious where people go right now. You know, it's an interesting thing. I mean, so do you still lecture, by the way, at Columbia?
No, I haven't for a couple of years now.
Yeah. But when you speak to sort of Gen Z or younger people, I mean, it's impossible to really feel what's going on inside of a computer, for instance, mm-hmm. where you have a sense of this. You build circuit. How do you think that the younger generation tinkers? Do they tinker only with code, or do you still find either people that you hire to work with you or people that you lecture or teach? Do you find that the same kind of opportunity for curiosity with physical things exists still?
I think that nowadays people are so drawn to software because of the job opportunities and because of funding opportunities. If you're building a startup, I think it's less likely that you'll find someone who tinkers, and that's what I've noticed firsthand, which I think is a shame. But there are plenty of tinkerers out there still, and NewLab is a great example of that.
I mean, if there's one thing that I see through you, is that people should be encouraged that tinkering can lead to something that is a physical thing in the world, and that the barriers to entry, we know the barriers to entry for creating an app are very low. The barriers to creating something physical seem overwhelming and overwhelmingly expensive. And it is more expensive, but we always hope that the future, the next thing to be come out of a dormitory is not a social network, but a factory.
And so, that's
this
a beautiful
is what,
lot.
And, I think that you're kind of proof to that that actually can happen.
Yeah.
But I
also think that, and this is going to sound obvious, but 3D printers have changed everything.
Yeah.
It's just the accessibility is enormous.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I remember when I first started working as an engineer, and part of my background story on the foldable device stuff is I actually worked with one of the smartest engineers I've ever come across or worked with, Chuck Hoberman, who's famous for his expandable robotic structures and whatnot and toys and medical devices and everything in between. But he was actually a co-founder, like a first employee of Honeybee Robotics, and started to explore those ideas for deployable structures back then. And I learned a lot about invention from him. He... back then when I was working with them, I remember it was so ridiculously expensive to get, you know, 3D printed parts. Like, our entire budget would be gone in one iteration of a prototype. And so what we would do back then is we would actually get the 3D prints and we would create molds. And then, of course, it's all about repetition. And, you know, you have like three unique parts that are just multiplied throughout the system. And if you look at the icosahedron or the different kinds of spheres and geometric structures that he's created, it's all, you know, a handful of parts that are just replicated. So it was perfect for that. That was a very inspiring.
Now you can just print the whole part, not have to have the mold.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So, no, it's amazing. Like, first, it's now... What was sort of first gen prototyper, now we're to sort of first gen replicator.
Right.
You know, it's the way I like to think of where 3D printing can go.
Definitely.
That's really exciting. So before we get into Avar, which I know we want to get to, I was interested to see you studied architecture as mm-hmm. well as mechanical engineering at Cooper Union.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about architecture and talk about how it's changed in your life and whether you think that automation has played any role in architecture?
I've always, when I was doing architecture, I was always thinking more as like along the lines of the structures, like, you know, the internal aspects of the architecture. And I felt like from a design perspective, I had developed my skills in that area pretty quickly, and I felt unsatisfied just designing things and you know, trying to create a nice aesthetic and that would sort of nicely complement the program of the building and things like that. I gravitated towards structures, and so actually at Cooper it's really a dual program. It's architectural design and structural engineering, and we studied under two of the greatest structural engineers in the world, Ahmed Rahimian, who was the lead structural engineer for World Trade Center and many famous buildings around the world. And then Israel Sanek, who was another huge pioneer in structural engineering, did a lot of great buildings in the city. And so that was really inspirational to myself and to a handful of other people that were really hardcore into structures. And so I think that mindset at that time I was getting more into mechanical engineering and doing that as well at Cooper Union. And, you know, there's a lot of overlap because you're thinking spatially. A mechanism is very similar to a structure, is very similar to an architectural design, and that you really, you know, if you're thinking of a circuit, it's flat and it's about connecting the dots and understanding, you know, Ohm's law and it's much more abstract, right?
Right, sure.
And mechanisms, it's like, okay, well, you have this circle that's this size and you have this circle that's this size.
I love
and
it.
You get a gear reduction.
Structural scaling from architectural down to micromechanical.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And also, you know, what was interesting about Hoberman is really a fusion of those two worlds, structures and mechanism design, and then also to some extent software, but it's like fairly primitive assembly code stuff. So
I love that. That's something I'll take with me. Right? It's like now that you say it, seems like something I should have thought of before, that connection, and I hadn't.
Right.
I connected over music before. Can you tell me the role music plays in your life, if any, to this date?
I haven't played the piano so much lately, but I grew up, I was very fortunate in that my family inherited a piano from an uncle, and it was a Steinway Grand. They couldn't afford it, something like that normally, but we inherited it, and I just was glued to that instrument for hours every day. Just like magical to me. And it was an escape from reality, and I just played and played and played and played, and I couldn't stop. And I started writing music by the time I was 12. And but I started when I was around 6, and I was very fortunate enough to have studied under Morton Estrin, who was a world class pianist, played at Carnegie Hall a lot, and was famous for the Scriabin etudes. And he was very strict, and I learned a lot about how to discipline myself and how to remain focused, how to finish something, right? I mean, you're playing these very complex pieces of music like Rachmaninoff and Chopin Polonaises, and And it's like so rigorous to learn that. And I was taught from the very beginning to memorize. You know, to memorize a piece like that and to play it with perfect dynamics and then to perform in front of a lot of people, it's incredibly nerve-wracking. You slip on the smallest thing. And
I've given myself the entire opposite experience, which is sort of go ahead and think there's no mistake. So I've let myself off the hook to not have that kind of rigor with my playing.
Right.
Do you ever do that? Do you ever completely improvise?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I much prefer improvising. I think by the time I was a teenager, I started to just go off on my own. And, you know, that's when I was writing music. And I loved improv so much that I actually would only write a little bit. And then the rest of it would just be improv over the original composition, which may have only been a page of music or two pages of music.
Yeah, I always find it so interesting in the music world. It's referred to as, you know, ideas and inventions when you're trying things out.
Yeah, like Bach. Yeah, Bach invention.
And in you know, in jazz, you're talking about how I want an idea around something. There's a sort of vocabulary tie between being an inventor of some physical thing and being an inventor of music.
Oh yeah, without question. They're so deeply tied to each other. And interestingly, I think a lot of people who are good at music, especially classical music, tend to be good at math. And I think that comes from the notion of understanding patterns.
Mm.
I mean, it's really all about patterns. I mean, if you're not improvising, if you're playing like Bach, you know, or some pre-structured piece of music, you're understanding these patterns and you're recreating them. And especially if you read music well. To me, it feels like there's a mathematical component
to it. There's probably a sense of pattern matching even with improvised music.
Absolutely. Because you have to understand exactly what chordal structure is happening in the background,
right.
And you have to accommodate that with something that's already pre-programmed in your mind.
Yeah, there's some kind of mapping that's going on in your mind,
right.
that you're trying to move from and try to resolve at any given time.
Yeah, and you have to figure out how to carefully stitch that together in real time. It's so difficult.
Yeah.
And the greatest jazz musicians do it so seamlessly.
Who do you love?
Let's see. I mean, I love
Jared
and Oscar Peterson, and huge fan of Chick Corea. Always been a huge fan. And I love Bela Fleck, some of these other avant-garde musicians who don't really fall into any particular category. I mean, Bela Fleck has won. I think he's the only person in his history who's won a Grammy in every single category.
Yeah.
His music is extraordinary, and his technique and his virtuosity is
Bach
unbelievable.
Bach on a banjo is pretty special.
It's very unusual.
Yeah.
Many musicians, Herbie Hancock and Miles Davis and, the list, Coltrane, the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
I also like meters, some stuff that's like jazz influence, but you know, when it transitioned to funk and rock, where there's
we should be sharing playlists. It sounds either will be complete overlap, or we'll discover little things that
it's very definitely
that's awesome. So with that in mind, what seems kind of opposite to the human experience of creating music, or even the structural scaling that you spoke of, and your influences from architecture to engineering to even the inspirations behind foldable displays, is artificial intelligence and automation. Now this is handing over a certain human task to something artificial. What do you think the role of artificial intelligence and automation should be in a world where we still have all of these humans and all of us creative forces hanging around?
Well, I think that my perspective is that it's the ultimate robot is a multiplier for work output, you know, and if there's a collaborative component, that's great. But I think ultimately it's just another tool, and every great tool is a multiplier for work output. I mean, it could be something simple like in the home, like a blender, a washing machine. Those are more forms of standard automation, right? Because there's no error correction required. Robotics, like the defining factor of robotics versus automation, is that there's error correction. And it was interesting. I was thinking about Kierkegaard, who's the father of existentialism, and you know, he wrote a book called The Concept of Anxiety, and defined this term angst and how you know, what's interesting is I was thinking about it. He was really defining the essence of robotics is, you know, as it relates to the human. And there's a perpetual feedback loop that's happening, and angst informs our decisions throughout the day. And this feeling of angst is there no matter what for everybody. It got me thinking about, like, is true AI something like an AI that can actually feel emotion, can feel pain, or can feel happiness?
Or and existential dread.
Right, existential dread, exactly. So,
That's the first time I've heard that kind of comparison. I love that. I mean, what may differentiate humanity from artificial intelligence is our ability to philosophize and consider our own existence. It's not necessarily just the act of creating, but of analysis in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if you think about Alan Turing's original papers on AI, you know, he was even talking in that very first paper, he was talking about, in the Turing test paper, he was talking about actually creating an artificial skin and how that wouldn't really be so practical. And so he was thinking it more of this test as being something that would be fruitful in a more abstract sense. It was very philosophical. It's almost like Aristotle's 8 books on physics. If you read bits and pieces and it's interpreted, in English, it's a little bit weird, but it's all very philosophical sounding. I mean, there was no mathematics in the original physics from Aristotle, and that was the interesting divergence from Galileo 1,300 years later when he started to apply math to physical science. And interestingly, because we were talking about music, Galileo's father was a musician.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he played the lute, and he did these experiments where he would stretch strings out and try and understand the mathematics of it. And the tension of a string is a function of the square root of its, the pitch is a function of the square root of its tension.
Right.
And so that was something that he worked out experiments for when Galileo was very young. That was a huge inspiration to him, and I found that to be fascinating because there's a direct correlation between music and the structure of music and building musical instruments and then, you know, building experiments and understanding it quantitatively.
Yeah, I always love the aspect of narrative when I speak to you. The historical perspective and where that pushes towards the future, but you know, it's always slightly different than the standard narrative, and that's really important. Do you feel this desire to, I know you've done some writing, you and I talked a little bit about film.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you feel is important for you to be able to place all this history into some type of context to lead towards a future?
Yeah, I think so. I think about it a lot because I'm intrigued by lineages, and that no one really comes up with a truly original idea. It's either been thought of before, or it's some derivative of something else that exists in the world, or it's some fusion of something, of two or three different things that exist. And I think about it a lot because, you know, the past is often a good predictor, way to predict the future. Not that anyone can truly predict the future, but it's a great way to make that to make estimates about what's going to happen next. And if you look at, you know, and I was talking about Aristotle versus Galileo, and then if you look at the next scientist in that lineage, you have, you know, Descartes, right? Because Descartes was around the same time, a little bit later. From Galileo, and invented Cartesian coordinate system, which is the fundamental structure for calculus. And then, interestingly, 1642 is when Galileo died, and that was the same year that Newton was born. And Newton was really the next scientist in that lineage. Because,
and he stood on shoulders of giants.
Right, exactly. And then from there it was, you know, Maxwell and Faraday, and then Einstein came along. And Einstein famously had 3 photos in his study. He had a photo of Newton, James Clerk Maxwell, and Michael Faraday. And I was always really intrigued by that because his work directly derives from those three scientists. You know, the speed of light was defined by a combination of Faraday's work and Maxwell, and he was upending Newton's Newtonian mechanics with understanding it through relativity and relativistic things moving at relativistic speeds. And you know, it's fascinating if you look at that lineage. And I'm really intrigued by innovation nodes. You know, Bell Labs being one of them. You know, it's extraordinary how much innovation and how many breakthrough inventions.
Yeah, I'm always interested in Edison
Labs. Yeah, Edison.
You know, how much came out of it?
Yeah.
You know, 30 people in a room.
Right. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, there's an exchange of energy when you have a node like that, and everyone is feeding off of each other's energy, and it's like that at New Lab. Yeah. And I felt it the first time I came here. It's just an extraordinary place.
So, tell me a bit about Avar.
Sure.
Of our robotics.
Yes. So we are working, our mission is to create the world's most cost-effective and productive robots. And more specifically, we're working on what is sometimes referred to as high-density robotics. The notion of many robots working together to perform a task, in this case, moving material around within a fulfillment center or a store of the future, or a store for present day, but you know, in the near future. And we started off with an automated pick worker. The robot was called Coda. I built it in 5 to 6 months, part-time, funded it, single-handedly did the whole thing. And then, you know, we moved into New Lab. And then that really kind of grabbed the attention of a lot of very large companies. And they were really impressed both with the engineering behind it and that I had done this so quickly and implemented it and just the simplicity of it. So that particular design, what's interesting about it is it has one actuator using a 4-bar linkage to grab a parcel. It can grab other items as well, but you know, parcels is the most the best application for it. Grab a parcel and then eject it with one actuator. So normally you would do that with maybe 6 actuators. And so, and with many feedback loops and many sensors. And so I was able to do it with a few sensors and a single actuator. Now it has a carrier plate and it also spins. So there are other actuators built into the robot, but to actually grab it and eject it only takes one actuator.
And this is really unique in the world, right?
Oh yeah, I've never seen anyone do anything like this. And end effectors can be very expensive, and so it was a low-cost end effector. The entire robot, you know, if we were to bring it to market as our first product, I mean, we moved on to mobile robots, but if we were to, it would be dramatically cheaper than what's out there. For you know, if you were to use a robotic arm with a custom end effector on, and so people got that right away at large companies, and you know, they were like, what's next? Can you build this into something much bigger? And so the issue with it is that the mechanics, so it's really a gantry-based robot, and that gantry is tied to a timing belt. And the problem with that is it's constrained. So you can't really go beyond 10 feet in the first iteration or 20 feet. So we really wanted to take that and expand it out to something much greater. And that was when the idea of putting wheels on it started to make sense. And you know, it just happened that Kiva and a lot of these robots that are like Kiva are taking that path, and we were, it turns out that, you know, putting an end effector with a carrier plate that could grab items and then store them locally on the robot was like a next move for us, and it made sense. It was kind of almost, it just evolved organically and intuitively.
I mean, I really want to make a distinction, and I want to see how you will make this distinction between robotics, especially in a factory or warehouse or store situation, something that is a replacement for human labor, you know, and like, you know, labor is just a physical task that one does,
right?
Not particularly involving unique creativity or philosophical pondering,
right.
And artificial intelligence being this system of either neural networks or other types of algorithms. If you now have these robotics that move, there has to be, I would guess, a sense of AI built into these now, because you're interacting in an environment outside of something that can be programmed by traditional logic. Is that correct?
Right, absolutely. It has to interface with an existing warehouse management system, There's a lot of customization and modularization of the software, and you know, plug and play is often desired by customers. And but yeah, AI is going to play a major role as everything evolves, for path planning, for you know, updating items in a warehouse in real time. So depending on what the items are, and you know, one of the things that we're really tackling is high variance in terms of shape, size, and weight. So a large variety of items, whether it's a small item or a larger item, or an item that's, you know, in the you know, a gallon of water that has an unusual shape to it, or something that's more like a bag contained within a bag. But ultimately, during certain seasons, certain parts of the year, there might be a higher demand for certain products. And so there's going to be an AI component to that to make
the understanding the environment.
Right. And so if you have your endpoint at one side of the building and the robots are being deployed from the other, you know, because the way our system is structured, they can cycle, they mostly cycle back around, but there's also a perpendicular component, so they can bypass certain sections. So, if your endpoint is over, you know, way on the other side, then those items might be updated in real time to the front of the system and things like that. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I would say nothing overly complex, but really crucial.
So what are some areas that robots or artificial intelligence, or whichever you'd like to go, or the combination of the two, should not be taken away from humans?
That's a great question. I think when there's an art to what someone's doing, and it's something that people have an emotional connection to. Interestingly, you know, someone serving coffee at Starbucks, I've read mixed reviews about that, but a lot of people enjoy that interaction.
Absolutely.
In the morning. And I hear jokes about people, you know, getting their name spelt wrong on the cup, and like there's this.
No, that's
like
really interesting. What we have to constantly be thinking about this, right? What we sometimes think is not a human task might be incredibly humanly important.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, I noticed this thing that, you know, I stay up and I'll play either chess on an iPad or backgammon or Go or whatever it might be, and you can play the AI, you know, right. And I find it completely unfulfilling. So I'd rather play online and play another human that I will never meet, not even chat with on that.
Right.
But for some reason, knowing that there's another human being.
Right.
And of
right.
course I could be fooled. It's easy Turing test to fool.
Right.
However, there's something that's like, I want to play against a human. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a challenge from, but it makes me think about what we are as humans.
Absolutely. And that's why I feel so strongly about the notion of gross amounts of repetitive labor and replacing those kinds of jobs.
Yes.
People don't if they tell you they love those jobs, then there's something wrong.
Well,
I mean, some people are okay with it, but a lot of injuries are caused by
or it's a necessity. It's a survival that they have.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
you make yourself feel okay with it.
Right.
I mean, it's sort of how you and I must feel about going and raising money. Like, we'll say we enjoy it. You know, I don't want to speak for you, but you can say this is fun.
Right.
This is amazing. I would love to outsource that to an AI.
Right.
But that's my equivalent of breaking my fingers on an assembly line.
Right.
But
right.
No, there is a self-deception that can go into it. But I completely agree with you. You know, why if there is something that you're going to spend this much of your life doing, being at work, doing something.
Absolutely.
I mean, when we are so lucky to have the brains we do as humans.
Absolutely.
You know, we're not as strong as a robot.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And
a robot can do the job
break
much better.
Easier.
Yep.
And that's, I think this is, there is a certain amount of self-awareness from society that's going to have to come. And from politicians.
Absolutely.
And from businesses.
It's
not an individual's task all. I mean, we have a tough world where people just have to survive somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to start to show that there are other options. And sometimes that is, try replacing something. Are you happy that is replaced or you're not? You yeah. know, and where does that go? Do we? The Starbucks example is fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's I mean they have, you know, sort of robotic butlers and waiters now, and but they're usually in conjunction with humans. You know, maybe certain aspects of that are automated and the human is still interacting with the customers in a restaurant. But writing about this recently, VisiCalc is an interesting example of an early form of automation in software. It was the first killer app on the Apple II, and I love that example because it's very abstract, and people really, it's replacing it's a form of work output, increasing work output, and it's replacing jobs to some extent in a very abstract sense, right? Because it's one person is doing the job of what would normally take, you know, a few people to do the same job in the same amount of time. But I find that people, and maybe this is because of science fiction and, you know, sort of the apocalyptic vision of robots taking over the world and destroying everything and, you know, killing people, you know, that a robot taking over a physical job is somehow, you know, people have a negative impulse and reaction to that, which I think is unfortunate, but I think it's because it's less abstract. The idea of someone grabbing an item and moving it from point A to point B, like a pick worker, automating that seems like we're directly taking over their job. You know, when someone using a dishwasher is no different. I mean, right? A dishwasher is just automating the process of you know, what you'd spend 20 minutes every day doing, which is to wash the dishes.
Yeah. Maybe we need a modern equivalent of Radio Shack. Let people realize what they can build rather than what they're just building for someone else.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And Adafruit, I would say, is probably the closest thing to that today. I mean, of course, they don't have a brick and mortar store. I think having a brick and mortar store is brilliant for hardware.
Yeah, me too.
You know, there's got to be a physical connection to go in, and I miss it so much. I spent so much time going to Radio Shack and going to those little drawers.
Oh man, yeah.
Esoteric chips, you know, 555 timers and, you know, digital logic chips and higher level processors and everything in between. It was just incredible, and every kind of resistor value and capacitor and transistor. And
yeah, I think that it's really clear to me that you have for a long time, probably most of your life, known what it was to be human. You were playing music. You were going to Radio Shack and putting things together. Then you were inventing. Then you were looking at these different structures and scale and how it relates to each other. It is incredibly human life for somebody who is right now dedicated to automation. And it makes 100% sense to me. And I would love to get your story out into the world. And you give an incredible context. So thank you so much for coming and talking to me today.
And it's great to be here.
Let's continue the conversation outside of this room.
Absolutely.
See each other more.
Sounds great.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve.
Take care.